I know just about everyone here has seen Roots. And I trust everyone in here has read the autobiography of Malcolm X. One more little slip back into my teaching days of 25 years when I taught the last decade of teaching. I would assign the autobiography of Malcolm X to almost every course, no matter what the course was. And that book serves so well, so very well. All those of you in the audience who are in teaching, you just get that book and put it on the reading list. And I'm telling you, no matter what the discipline, you're going to find something in that book that will be relevant to your discipline. Yes. Alex Haley is here tonight. I must say that it is particularly special and significant to have Alex Haley with us at this marvelous, enthralling, wonderful event. Alex Haley.
Well, needless to say, thank you. I was sitting down in front earlier with Sister Betty Chabaz, and we were just kind of exchanging little bits to each other. And I said at one point to her, you know, Malcolm sees us all here tonight. And she said, I know it. And then I was thinking about that when other people have sort of expressed the same feeling. Brother C. Eric said something very similar. And back behind the curtains, before we came out here, Brother Clark said as much, and so did Amara Bakri. In his, all of us in our ways seem to have that sense of Malcolm's presence. And I was tickled when Eric Lincoln said that he could see Malcolm sitting over there impatiently waiting for him to finish talking. Because all of us who were close to him know that one of the biggest things about Malcolm was his intense sense of time. He was always watching his watch. And as a matter of fact, he had a saying that whenever he met anybody, one of the first things he would notice was, did they wear a watch? And if they didn't wear a watch, he didn't have any time. He didn't say boo to them because he didn't want to waste his time with them. That was his feeling about it. I guess most of us do some sort of little biographical thing. For myself, the first time I met Malcolm, I had been in the military service. I had been in the U.S. Coast Guard for 20 years, and I had just retired. And it was during that time that I had kind of, over the years, taught myself to write up to the point that I had now begun to sell to the Reader's Digest, which was a tough magazine to sell to. And I was extremely surprised when, after I got out of the service, the very first assignment, I went up and told them that there was this new kind of phenomenon called the Nation of Islam, or colloquially the Black Muslims. And I just kind of said it to them because I wanted to establish that I would like to write that if they later down the line decide they would like to do something about such an organization. And they surprised me very much by saying right then that yes, they would like to have it, and that they would like me to do a piece which told what people said against the organization as well as what the organization's members said of it. And then I found, with some little questioning, somebody, I guess just looking in the newspapers, that the spokesman was this man called Malcolm X. And I wasn't quite certain how to get in touch with him, but I went to the Nation of Islam restaurant in Harlem, 116th, wasn't it right? 116th, huh? Yeah, okay, well that was it. And And I went in, and I must say I was really rather timid, having heard the reputation of this man. And I was standing there, and I remember somebody went by me with a piece of roast chicken. I never forget that, because it looked so good, and it had all that, you know. But I had to keep a mind on why I was there. And there was this man whom I just peripherally happened to notice in a phone booth. And what I noticed was he sort of gave you the impression of Ichabod Crane in a phone booth. His knees were up high. He was too tall to be in the booth, in fact. And he was just kind of looking at me, and I later learned that was the Malcolm X whom I'd come to see. And he came out, and in his very frank, direct way, he said, you are a spy sent by the white man. So I assured him that I wasn't, that as a matter of fact, I had a letter from the white man to prove I wasn't, you know. So Malcolm told me that he would not undertake such a responsibility, that I would have to talk with his leader, Mr. Elijah Muhammad, who was in Chicago. And he right there got on the phone and called Mr. Muhammad and came back and told me that Mr. Muhammad would see me. And I got expense money from the magazine, and at that time I couldn't buy a ticket to Chicago without somebody buying it. And so I flew to Chicago, and I think it was a Saturday, because the next afternoon, there in Mr. Muhammad's home, they were having a very formal dinner. And Mr. Muhammad invited me to come to dinner, and I knew very well I was being kind of appraised to see whether or not he would approve this article to be written by me. And everything was going fine. The food there was wonderful too. And it was being served, the table was being served by three young sisters who wore kind of veils and things. And one of them in particular was just something else. And as she went around serving whatever she had, I was kind of just following her without thinking about it, looking at her. And it wasn't long before I found that she moved behind Mr. Muhammad. I was looking right in his eyes, and he knew exactly what I'd been doing, was watching her around, and he was not smiling. But afterwards he told me that he would give me an opportunity to write an article about them if I would agree to do what the magazine had said, is tell their story as well as what people said against them. And then I went back. He had called Malcolm, and Malcolm talked to me. And Malcolm introduced me to other members of the Nation of Islam, and I got together pretty quickly a story that was titled Mr. Muhammad Speaks, that appeared in the Reader's Digest in the early 1960s. And subsequently, I got a nice letter from Mr. Muhammad saying that I had done what I agreed to do, and the magazine had as well. And Malcolm telephoned me. And it was during this period that Dr. Lincoln was, we were buddies. I don't remember exactly how we even met, to tell you the truth, but he was at Boston University. And Malcolm worked sort of with both of us, plus Lou Lomax, whom he mentioned. And Malcolm had a kind of it was sort of a thing like maintaining a little family of people in different things. There were a few of us who were journalists, and he kind of played us one against the other in a nice way. He liked to do things like you might have two people interviewing him. I know specifically one time Lou Lomax and I both were interviewing Malcolm separately for different articles. And Malcolm had told both of us to go take rooms in the Americana Hotel. Is it still named Americana? Well, whatever it was. It's a Sheraton now. Well, then it was Americana. So there Lou was in one room, and I was in the other, in another room in the Americana. Neither of us knew the other was there, and Malcolm was letting each of us interview him separately. He just kind of liked those kind of little intrigues. And he used to have a saying about Lomax in particular. As Brother Lincoln says, Lomax Lou Lomax was kind of brash. He would, that's putting it charitably, Lou Lomax would do anything. And Malcolm used to have a saying, he said, when I see Lomax go by me, I follow him because I know he's either on to something or into something. And Malcolm liked to follow him. I made some cards just to give myself some sense of chronology. One of the things that looking back upon it that I really just am amazed at about the discipline, the self-discipline of Malcolm, was that I never knew until very late in my company with Malcolm, I had no idea that he was having problems within the Nation of Islam. He never by word or hint or act or anything let me have any idea of that for at least a year and a half. And the fact was, I would later learn that he was in difficulty with the organization from the very time I met him. But he just never talked about it. For about the first 2 months after the agreement had been made that I would do a book about him, and how that happened was, I did an interview of Malcolm. I had begun writing for an exciting new magazine that had come along, and I first was writing for the Reader's Digest. Then this other magazine came along, and a lot of magazine writers were really trying to get into it because it paid well, it was exciting to readers and everything. And so they hired me to do interviews of highly controversial people. And I found myself in a position of writing for two magazines, neither of which wanted you even to mention the name of the other in their offices. And that was the Reader's Digest and Playboy. And Playboy had me doing interviews of people like the American Nazi George Lincoln Rockwell, of Cassius Clay, as was mentioned when he was Cassius Clay. And as a matter of fact, I was interviewing him at the time you mentioned when he went down and fought. It was Liston, was it not? It was Liston. And I remember Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay telling me later, he said, do you remember after the second round that I hollered something at him? And I said, yeah, well, you could see that he hollered something at him. And he said, well, what I hollered was, I got you now, you big sucker. And the reason he said that was because he had in training let the word get out to Liston's camp that he was scared to death. And that was what had gotten Liston into training to do two rounds only. And so when the second round was over, then Muhammad Ali knew he had him. That was who he said. And Malcolm took the greatest of pride. There were two people, in my experience with Malcolm, whom he regarded pretty much as little brothers, and they were proud to be his little brothers. And one of them was at the time Cassius Clay, and the other was Louis Farrakhan. And if you listen to Farrakhan today and close your eyes, you sort of hear the cadence of Malcolm as if he practiced to sound like Malcolm when he talked. They were both very proud of that little brother status. But for myself, when I got with Malcolm to do the book, which resulted from a publisher reading the Playboy interview and asking Malcolm if he would tell his life in book length, because nobody knew anything about Malcolm. All he ever said, he would hardly ever repeat three sentences without saying, I was taught by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, or something to that effect. And he'd never said a word about himself. And so this publisher was Ken McCormick at Doubleday, asked Malcolm, would he tell his life in book length? And Malcolm demurred about it. He finally agreed. And then Malcolm asked me if I would be the one to write the book, as he'd come to know me somewhat during the Reader's Digest and Playboy interviews. And I was pleased, honored, flattered to have this opportunity. And so I began to work with him. At the time, I lived in Greenwich Village, 92 Grove Street, right off Sheridan Square. And I had a place, a basement. And it was, fortunately, kind of a long, oblong room. And Malcolm would come down there about twice a week. He would generally get there around 9:30. And he would stay until 11:30, midnight or so. When he arrived, his first thing, always, there was not even a talk about it, he'd go straight to the phone and call Sister Betty, and they would talk. she would give him messages and whatnot, and he would tell her that he planned to be home before midnight. And she knew good and well he wasn't going to get home before midnight, but he would always tell her that. And finally, he and I got into supposedly interviewing him. I would say that 2 months passed, and I would ask him questions as artfully as I knew how. I had a typewriter at the time. It was what they used to call a silent typewriter. It didn't make as much noise as most. And I sat kind of in a corner, and I can type very rapidly and touch type, so I was just sort of taking Cabe Lee's notes, you know, where you write it much the same as if you were sending a telegram. If somebody says a 10-word sentence, you don't really need to write more than 4 or at most 5 words to know pretty much what they said. And a couple of months went by, and I hadn't been able to get Malcolm to say boo about himself. Everything would come up. He would go right back again to the greater glories of the Nation of Islam, Mr. Muhammad. And I would say, when I got the nerve, Mr. Malcolm, I know they're both marvelous, but we really have to get something about you, because that's what this book is about. And finally, it came to me that I had to either go to the publisher and tell them that I couldn't get through to him, that they should either get another writer or drop their project, whatever they wanted to do. And then one night, it was in January, snow was knee-deep. Malcolm came down to my place down there, and he strode that room. He was like, not just this night, every night, he was like a caged tiger when he'd come in there. He just walked. He made an oval, I guess 100 times in the course of a night. He didn't want to sit down. He had big feet. He would just sort of, well, he did. He had big feet. And he would, and the way, what? Where are you? What size were your shoes, Ben? 14. They were size 14, that's what they were. But, and he liked to walk, and this particular night, again, I said to him, for maybe the 15th time, not that night, but over all the times I had said to him, maybe 15 times, Mr. Malcolm, we just have to get something about you. And this time, it just made him angry. He had a little houndstooth top coat, and he snatched it up, and I remember thinking, just sort of flashed through my head, that coat's too light for this weather. And he grabbed it up on his arm, and he went striding toward the door, and he reached for the handle and snatched it. And I don't know why on earth I said to him, it surely was not something I thought, it surely was not something you would say to an angry Malcolm. Just as he got the doors cracked open, snatching it open to go out, I saw the snow banked up over the door jamb. And I just said to him rather quietly, I said, Mr. Malcolm, could you tell me something about your mother? And I remember he just stopped as if he were a marionette on a string. And rather slowly, he closed the door, he turned, and he began to walk again. And he probably made 3 circuits of the room before he spoke. And when he did, his voice was up a little, like another register. And he was speaking rather as if it was stream of consciousness. And he said something like, it's funny you should ask me that. I can remember the dresses she wore were old and faded and gray. And then he walked some more. And he said, I remember she was always bent over the stove trying to stretch whatever little we had. And you know what, that man that night walked that floor on up until probably 3:30 or 4 in the morning. I never asked him a thing. He just spilled out of it what essentially is now to be found in the first chapter of the autobiography of Malcolm X, which is appropriately titled Nightmare. A little boy about 7 years old at the time. Was he 6? Yeah, I have to be careful about my facts here tonight, but